Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, girl.
Hey, girl.
You guys, what's going on?
Nothing. What's up with you?
You guys, this is my favorite day. I love it when we get to take the episode one of a series and put it on the regular feed. Before we say anything else, you guys, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Our coverage of this, I think, is some of the best coverage we have ever done. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it helps that the series itself is really well made and also fits the TCO format really well. And it's also very well made. And we were really passionate about it. So
I mean, it is definitely one of the best series I've ever watched. I have a friend in it, it turns out. It's so crazy.
I know. My big question is the famous Paul Holes blazer, does it make an appearance in F1? I can't remember. Find out. Let's all find out together. I'm obsessed with Paul Holes in that blazer. It's my favorite thing.
You guys, the other thing, Nancy Miller, who appears in episode one, she was Michelle McNamara's editor for the LA Magazine piece about the Golden State Killer that was eventually turned into the book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. We loved her in this, and she is a fan, you guys. She's on the Patreon feed. She reached out to us. We did an interview with her, and it's live on Patreon as of today. So listen to this. You can find the rest of the episodes of I'll Be Gone in the Dark, in addition to like 150 other full bonus episodes, on Patreon right now, and our interview with Nancy Miller.
I know. And she reached out after we were done with the coverage of it, right?
Yes.
And she was like,
yes.
Hey, so I listened to all of it. And, you know, we're holding our breath in that first sentence of the email where it's where is this going to go? And thankfully, she's like, a friend told her about the podcast. She joined Lady Pates. She listened to all of it. She reached out, and now we are best friends, and no one can tell me differently. We are best friends with Nancy Miller.
So enjoy episode one of All Begun in the Dark. You can get the rest of the series right now on Patreon, and we're going to say bye at the end.
Yeah. All right. Enjoy.
Go. Get out of here, you.
Go. Well, don't. I mean, stay. Listen to the pod, but don't. We'll go. We'll see you later.
Right. Hey, girl.
Hey, girl.
Girl, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, episode one, Murder Habit. Look, can I tell you, when this book came out, I bought it this fucking second it came out. I was obsessed.
Yeah, I love this so much. Not the same vibe as McCallion's, so to speak, but this is so my speed. I mean, come on. This is HBO at its finest. I love it.
I totally agree. The whole thing about the order of events was that Michelle McNamara was obviously obsessed with the Golden State Killer. She named him the Golden State Killer. Michelle McNamara, unfortunately died and didn't finish the book. So right after she died, they discovered who the Golden State Killer was. Then her book came out. It was crazy town.
Yeah. There's just a lot of familiar faces here.
Oh, we have friends in this documentary.
And also, so we get Michelle McNamara's voice a lot.
Yes.
But we also get a narrator reading parts of her book or parts of the blog. Do you know who it is?
No.
It's Amy Ryan, also known as Holly Flax from The Office, and Beattie from The Wire.
It's Amy Ryan? I love, like multi-Academy Award nominee Amy Ryan.
Yeah, and I'm like, Holly Flax from The Office, like a basic bitch. I'll just say it.
Well, so it opens with, we get a whole bunch of like voicemails from Michelle McNamara. It's so great that we hear her voice and she's very present in this.
I'm a crime writer in Los Angeles. I am doing a series on unsolved crimes.
Hi, Kate. This is Michelle McNamara.
Hey, it's Michelle.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. I write a lot about unsolved cases. One that I am very fascinated with is the East Area Rapist Original Night Stalker case.
We learn that the case that she's most obsessed with is, guys, bear with me on this, East Area Rapist / Original Night Stalker. They give him the moniker Earons.
Earons.
I have on other podcasts screamed about how that is the worst, most annoying, like, eyesore of a fucking name for a serial killer. It makes me crazy. Earons.
Earons. I know. And then so people say it like it's nothing. Like, it's just like, I had pancakes for breakfast. It's like, yeah, so she was really obsessed with Earons.
Earons. It's terrible. And everyone's like, I don't know why no one knows about this case. I don't know why it never caught on. Eurons? You guys, you get to choose between the Zodiac Killer or Eurons. Like, who's going to get more media attention, you guys?
And Michelle doesn't love that we're still talking about Zodiac, but I'm like, but Zodiac versus exactly what you said, or Eurons. Like, Eurons, people, girl. Even if they think, like, you know, he murdered people during their time of the Zodiac. No, he didn't. No. But people are interested that you're Zodiac. Oh.
Exactly.
Now, hold
exactly,
on a second.
Exactly.
Eurons, pass.
But I wanted to say, like, the thing about Michelle, too, that is, like, so relatable is that she says the things out loud that I think some of us are afraid to say. And mm-hmm. she was, like, the first to say it. And you know that she was the first to say it because we get Karen Kilgraff from My Favorite Murder.
I started reading Michelle's blog, True Crime Diary, basically on a recommendation. And I was obsessed with it. Like, she couldn't post enough. Her stories and the way she told them made them so memorable. You know, they all stuck with you.
The My Favorite Murder women are so credited. And I mean, I give so much thanks to them for, like, creating a genre that we could easily slide into and, like, make a living as podcasters,
yeah.
you know? But, like, we give them credit for being there first with My Favorite Murder, which doesn't sound controversial anymore. But when it first came out, like, that name of that podcast, even I was like, oh, you're not allowed to do that. But Karen Kilgraff is here to tell us later that Michelle did it first. Like, she was the first one out there saying, I'm obsessed with this. I can't get enough of it. I have a murder habit and I was going to feed it for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Then we get the opening credits. Another Amy I love is here. Amy Mann is doing this So My Speed, this nice and creepy but kind of motivating cover of Leonard Cohen's Avalanche.
Well, I stepped into an avalanche. It covered up my soul.
How did I not know that was Amy Mann? I love Amy Mann. So it's April 24th, 2018, and we're in, like, a book warehouse where Patton Oswalt, who was Michelle McNamara's husband, is, like, signing books. And I was like, why is he signing those?
Right, because he wrote the afterword.
Yes, and they got to that very quickly, but I was like, why is he signing his wife's book? That's really weird.
I was, like, hypnotized by the sound and the rhythm of him signing those books. Did you catch that?
Yes. I've written a couple books, none that were ever nearly popular enough to need this, but I've been in the room when this has happened for other authors, which is just, it's an assembly line where they, like, hand the books down and they've got the thing already in, so you turn it over, you sign it, you slam it. You turn it over, you sign it, you slam it.
That sound. I know. I'm like, it doesn't sound like that when I sign the TCO postcards that we sent to everybody. I don't have that cool sound.
The one thing I want to say, so Patton Oswalt is talking about the process of, like, writing this afterword, and he's saying that, like,
you know, there were those moments when I would want to just, like, run upstairs and go tell her something because it felt like I was listening to her, and then I'm like, oh no, she's not, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was a very dark week for me.
And that's when you realize, okay, so this is going to be incredibly well made.
Yes.
And it's going to be very moving with Michelle and, like, what she did for this case and, like, a badass woman and women working together and dealing with, like, some sexual violence stuff. And that's horrible. And then the relationship of these two people who, like, adored each other.
I was just going to say, like, I feel like Patton Oswalt is maybe the nicest person in the world. I've never met him. I don't know him. But, like, he seems so genuine and sweet to me. And, like, he loved her so much, you know? So we're jumping back in time now. So it's 7 years before Patton Oswalt is sitting there signing the books. And we get this video interview of Michelle. I don't know what it's for, but it's from November 11th, 2001. And she's talking about, like, the tragedy of this Eurons case. I have to, because it's two words. It's not Eurons. It's, like, Eurons.
Ear/ons. But she already coined Golden State Killer. So you can, if you feel better saying Golden State Killer, let's do that. Because Eurons.
I know.
And just so you know, because Patton Oswalt says it, so people, like, we meet people who still go by Eurons because they were there right in the beginning. So Eurons is the Golden State Killer. We are going to do Golden State Killer, right? Is that fair
enough?
Thank
you, girl. Thank you. What a nice thing you just did for me. Thank you.
I have your back always. And things like this in particular.
Yeah, and this is where she says that, like,
the great tragedy of this case to me is that it's not better known. I mean, I can't, you know, like, you know, I wish Zodiac would get rid of his 15 minutes of fame so that Eurons could get a little heat, you know?
Right. Girl, I thought of you. She's like, I wish the Zodiac would get done with his 10 minutes so that the Golden State Killer could get some heat.
I agree. I'm with her on this. Like, it's Arthur Lee Allen. I mean, my God, let's move on. Let's drag somebody else, for God's sake. I'm all about getting justice and getting attention on this stuff. So, Michelle, I'm with you.
So the guy says to her, like, how did you even learn about this case? And she says, like,
I think it was just 4 or 5 years ago that I happened to be home one night and one of the E! Shows or something was on. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I've never, what? And Larry Crompton's book kind of got me. That's been the last like year kind of obsession.
Right.
Started with that book.
She heard about it on some E! Show, and she like looked it up on the internet and finds this guy's book, and she becomes obsessed with it.
Right, so it's Sudden Terror by Larry Crompton. And then suddenly, I'm like, Larry Crompton's here!
Right, right, because I thought he was just like some author. No, you guys, he was like the lead detective on the case.
He's a retired lieutenant. He worked on the task force in the 70s. He has so many files. He's very well organized.
Are you going to say it?
I would say bless this mess. But Larry has everything in this very cool-looking, antique-looking trunk, which I really, really appreciate.
It's very well organized. It does feel a little bit like Steve Tipton was like, let me get my hands on those files. And he put it in envelopes. It's all alphabetized. Yeah,
it's totally. Color-coded.
But it's like all these, and this kind of blew my mind. It's like everything he's showing us in this trunk are all of the different, like, they were suspects that looked really good that then they ruled out. And it's sort of like, oh my God, how terrifying is it that there was enough fucking creepy dudes like night stalking through Sacramento in the 70s that there's this many files and they all looked good.
Yeah, welcome to the world. Am I right? Everything's the worst. And the thing about Larry is that he was there from the beginning and he's here with us now. So he has this really incredible perspective because he's saying today, he's like, because we're at like the house, like the first house that the Golden State Killer ever attacked someone in.
Yeah.
And Larry's like,
It's hard to believe this, but when I walked into the house, I had a feeling. The hair on the back of my neck would just feel like it was standing up. It was just the fear that was in the victims and listening to what they said. It just had a feeling that this is a madman.
Do you remember this from Don't F with Cats? That detective that we loved so much had the same exact thing. She was saying that, like, when I walked into that apartment where he dismembered the man and that whole horrible thing, she's like, I felt him. I felt him. It was like I was seeing through his eyes, you know? And as soon as I heard this here, I was like, no, Larry, this doesn't sound crazy, girl. We've heard this before. People who are great at your job, you guys have these feelings.
Right, because he's like, we'd never dealt like anything like this before, and we felt it. Oh, my God, look. Do you see?
I know. Yeah, I know.
The chills. So we learned throughout just really horrible, super trigger warning details about this guy. And I got to tell you, girl, this was like really hard for me to watch and listen to. But I love the fact that we have Michelle and some badass women at the helm of this. So buckle up, everybody.
Yeah, like I forget that because I read this book, I knew all of this information about him.
Right.
But like, you know, we learned that
he always wore a mask, always wore gloves, talked through clenched teeth. Set the houses up prior to the victims arriving. Unlock doors and windows. Open gates.
This is the most terrifying thing to me. He would stalk the neighborhoods, we're going to learn. Mm-hmm. And he would choose his victims, and he was methodical about it. And he would learn their routines, and then he would like literally break into their houses before they got home and set it up so he had basically his equipment already placed around the house.
He would prep the house.
Yeah.
He would do prep. And he would put like ligatures and stuff and like weapons behind pillows. So he would just be grabbing stuff from behind your pillow, under your couch.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're like, where the fuck did that come from? Oh, because he put it there yesterday. That's
right.
So terrifying.
And then when he would go to commit the crimes, we learn, and I remember reading this in the book and being like, this is, I was able to see this in my mind in a way that like, it's never left me. I think about this from time to time. He would rummage through the kitchen and find like china, like a tea set.
Like their dishes, their dishes.
Yeah. I don't know why I had to make it fancy, girl.
Yeah, I don't know. I was like, girl, it's bad. Again, when it's bad enough, we don't have to exaggerate. Just the facts, ma'am. Ma'am, just the facts.
Yeah, exactly. But he would like take the tied up man and put him like face down in the living room and balance like plates and glasses on him. And he would say, if I hear these glasses rumble, I'm going to kill your wife.
Yeah. And so Larry is telling us like,
my job is to catch him and I didn't do that. And but I can't let it go.
Oh, you're a good one. Right, Larry?
Don't.
Larry, wait a second. I can feel like I'm falling for you, Larry. And I've been hurt so many times.
I know.
And it's just,
please don't end up being garbage, Larry.
I'm just now learning to love again.
Right. Wait, what was her name? The lawyer from the Menendez case, Leslie Abramson. God, she really fucking turned on you, girl.
She really did. It was really hard.
I know.
And Larry, I'm going to go easy on this, but right now it's feeling really great. And like, girl, you and I, we're at brunch and you're like, be careful. Remember what happened last time? And I'm like, no, I just feel it. I really get like a good energy. And so I'm going to, fingers crossed, I'm holding my breath.
I know. And so we're back with Patton Oswalt, and he's saying like,
I remember Michelle ultimately wanted to serve helping to get this guy caught. She looked at it from the hopeful, optimistic humans putting puzzles together, trying to get closure, trying to make sense of violence and despair.
The thing about Michelle was that she really wanted to be a part of like catching this guy.
And it wasn't about, I say this term a lot, it wasn't like torture porn. It wasn't like glorifying anything. It actually kept her up at night because she's like, I got to get him. I have to get this guy.
More than that, it was like, I think I know how. She like comes to the understanding that she's one of those people that gets like these clues locked in her brain. She can put puzzle pieces together from things that she learned 2 years ago and things that she learned yesterday. So she's saying to us that like,
what I love is this intersection of sort of technology and crime solving, in that people can get sort of wheeled out of their house for something they did in 1957 because of the internet, because of DNA. I really get off on that. That is so amazing to me.
I love the idea that someone can get wheeled out of their house for something they did in 1953. And I saw myself so hard in that moment. But I love, she's such a writer and she's such an incredible communicator, that like wheeled out of their house to me means that they're like some decrepit 98-year-old asshole who's being wheeled out of their house in the winter.
Spoiler, that's literally what happens in this case.
But it's also Robert Durst, like, okay, bye-bye, like from like being wheeled out of the house, like, everyone have a great weekend, I'm getting out of this. But like wheeled out of their house for something they did in 1953. I was like, girl, speak in my language, let's do this, let's get them all.
So we get some background on Michelle, like how she sort of ended up where she is in this, like sort of with her obsession with the Golden State Killer. And we learn about her blog. She had a blog in like 2007 called True Crime Diaries.
What led you to starting this blog?
Well, I always followed crime stories and that I was always a writer. So I started it on a lark, really.
She wasn't trying to be famous. She was just trying to like start a blog about this thing that she had an interest in. And this is where we get Karen Kilgraff saying like her stories really stuck with you. And like the difference between Michelle and the other like true crime shit you'd see on the internet was that Michelle was like this beautiful writer. So her stories really like stuck with you.
And she also humanized these people. It wasn't about the torture porn. It wasn't trying to get into like, ooh, and then what other bad thing happened? It was like, no, the victims are real people.
Yeah.
And we should give them a voice and give them justice. You know who agrees?
Our friend Billy Jensen.
Did you catch what his lower third is?
No.
Crime writer, comma, citizen detective.
Yes, girl.
Billy, hey girl, nice gigantic office you have there. My goodness.
I know. So like, I said this a little bit at the top about how like the idea of like loving true crime was something that everyone sort of like always secretly felt, but Michelle was like the first person to like start saying it out loud. So we get this like radio interview. Do you want to take it? You look like you wanted to take it.
I just wanted to say that it feels to me that she was at least doing it right, in the sense where she wasn't glorifying this person. I mean, we've seen people like with, you know, Charles Manson's face on their shirt,
right,
and all this shit.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
she wasn't doing that. So she spoke to a lot of people who were interested, but horrified and fascinated and wanted to get to the bottom of it. And it wasn't like, isn't this the coolest story? Or was it romanticizing any of it? So she did both of them in kind of a beautifully written way. Like, her words are like, I want to use the word intoxicating, but how obnoxious is that? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah. And because she does this interview with this like DJ or whoever it is, who's like,
she is a truth seeker is what she is. Let's face it. You have a career. You have a life because people are always going to get murdered.
Well,
you
yeah.
deal in the devil.
The murder biz.
You know, girl, you're always going to have a career because you're in the murder business and people are always going to get murdered, girl. And Michelle's like, you can tell she does not love that characterization of what she does. Even though, if we're being honest, it's kind of true. And that's where Karen Kilgraff, who's like became famous for making the first true crime comedy podcast, is like, mm-hmm. yeah, girl, like nothing was like that in 2007.
Right. So we jump to 2007. And we're in Jenner, California, and we get like Michelle's research footage, and we learn that this Jenner case was this major turning point for Michelle. She was discussing it on her blog, and basically, the title of the blog should have been, "This is why you should never go camping."
Right.
Essentially.
Yeah, and she's also being interviewed by her husband. I guess Patton, like, had a radio show or whatever. And Patton is saying, like, tell me about this case. There's something going on in the Northwest. And, like, it's so chilling to hear it, but it's also like, oh my God, girl, tell me more. She has this theory that there's a, and I remember this. I remember this theory that there's a serial killer, like an active working serial killer in the Northwest who's killing hikers or campers out, basically.
Couples out camping. Again, yeah. Never go camping.
How many times do we have to tell you, you guys?
Yeah, I mean, I have a theory that there's a serial killer operating in the Northwest who is killing couples, like, out camping. There's been about 4 or 5 cases where there seems to be no motive and they are both shot in the head.
She's like, it's super random. There's no motive. And I'm like, so don't go outside ever. Yeah, I was doing it before it was cool. Quarantine. Okay. I'm not going camping regardless.
But so she decides she's got to go, like, see this for herself. So, you know, there's these 4 different couples that have been found murdered, shot at very close range. And she goes to this place called Jenner and she, like, goes down to this beach.
It's not easy to get to this beach. You have to negotiate a tricky path down a rocky cliff.
If you're the murderer, you had to really either know these people were there or really want to get to them or both. And she hikes her way down to this beach to sort of see this crime scene. And we're told that, like, her doing this really changed everything. And guys, this is foreshadowing for what she does in the Golden State Killer case. That's why we're learning this. That in order for her to be able to write the way that she wanted to write, she had to go to these places and really be able to investigate them in person.
Yeah, because Patton Oswalt's like, she knew she couldn't just click around.
The act of actually going to the crime scene and walking the case made her go, oh, yeah, I can't just be clicking on the internet. I have to go visit places and look at places. It changed the way she wrote about it.
So now she's being interviewed about this news story that she saw about...
This is bananas.
This is one of those things where it's like, she was here to do a certain kind of work, and this was the work she was here to do.
Totally.
She's brilliant at it. She just has she had a great brain for this kind of stuff.
Totally.
So she sees this news story about a kidnapping of a 13-year-old boy, and she's watching this, and her brain, in this amazing way it works, goes, you know what? That kind of reminds me of this case that nobody knows about from, like, 5 years ago.
There were things that were interesting to me, so I posted that I think whoever took this boy, Ben Ownby, probably also took this kid, Sean Hornbeck, and I posted it on a Wednesday. That Friday, the police in St. Louis went to investigate a tip about where Ben Ownby might be, and they knocked on the door, and Sean Hornbeck opened the door.
I'm getting chills.
I can't.
Girl, I remember when this happened. I remember being like, what the fuck?
And whoever's asking her about it is like, so, just to be clear, it's the boy who was kidnapped. I'm like, why aren't you saying, wait a second, so the kid from 5 years ago that nobody knew about, he's the one who answered the door?
And Michelle predicted it. She just knew. She was like, the way her brain works, she'd read a story about this kidnapping from 5 years ago, probably 5 years ago, and when she's, like, mm-hmm. learning about this kidnapping that just happened, she's like, wait, this really reminds me of that other thing from 5 fucking years ago.
I mean...
And she was absolutely right. I mean, like, again, her brain was just designed to do this shit.
Exactly. And it's just like, you can almost see, like, when they eventually make the movie about this.
Yeah.
Someone will do, like, where you just get into her brain and we see, like, boop, 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 like, see her connect stuff, you know?
Totally.
Like, I feel like you just have to visualize her brain because it's just like lights and like lines connecting. And I'm like, is there more wine in the fridge?
I know.
I'm really mad about this, but is there, like, more wine anywhere? Can I just scream at Patrick about it for 2 mm-hmm. hours? Cool. Mm-hmm. And Michelle McNamara is going to the beach and solving stuff on her blog.
Some people are meant to solve crimes. Other people are meant to get drunk and talk about them doing it.
Girl. And scream about it.
So this is where Patton is saying to us, like,
I cannot remember the specific time we started talking about Eron's because every day there was so many cases she was following up. And then just organically, that became the thing that got narrowed down.
She was great at solving these crimes. She was really obsessed with true crime. She was always working on 100 different things. But eventually, it just got narrowed down to her obsession with the Golden State Killer.
Right. And so now we meet Nancy Miller.
Oh, my God. I love Nancy Miller. Nancy Miller is my kind of people.
I love Nancy Miller. Don't love her editor, who really sounds like a piece of work. But Nancy Miller, I love. So Nancy Miller is the former deputy editor of Los Angeles Magazine.
Yeah.
And she meets Michelle, and she is gushing over Michelle just like we are. She was so smart. She was so cool.
And she was so smart and so cool and down to earth. and her shit was together. Not only that, I really liked how she was unpretentious in a obviously a pretty pretentious city and business. I remember she wore these like clogs. She had a backpack like a that she bought at Target, and she just showed up totally like in a flannel shirt and just as like low-key as possible.
Michelle showed up to this meeting the way that I would show up to this meeting, looking frumpy, wearing a flannel, Target backpack, clogs, like, and she loves this about Michelle, that, like, Michelle's married to this, like, super famous guy, but she's not, like, pretentious about it at all. She, like, shows up to this meeting, and Michelle knows, like, the goods that she has to offer is this incredible story that she has. But so, Nancy is telling us, like, look, we went to this cafe, we sat down at 11 a.m., we didn't leave until 3, because she was telling me this crazy story about this guy. And, you know, cuts back and forth between Nancy talking and Michelle talking, but the gist of it is that this guy that Michelle is obsessed with, he was the worst serial offender in modern history that nobody knows about. He raped over 50 women in California. He killed 10 people, and he's never been caught. And Nancy is all of us.
This guy was one of the most prolific, violent, brutal serial rapists and eventually a murderer. And I had never heard of him. Like, you'd heard of Zodiac Killer, you heard Son of Sam, like, you hear of all of these big, especially in the 70s and 80s, which seemed to be the most fertile period for these serial killer stories. And I had never heard of him.
Girl, how do I not know this story? Nancy, I'll tell you how you don't know this story. Because they named him Ear-Ons, girl, and nobody wants to write about
it. Ear-slash-Ons. The slash is silent. Like, what the...
But, like, this is, Michelle is just giving us more information. Like, this guy was so fucking creepy. He would eat in people's kitchens. He would hide the ligatures and weapons in people's homes. Again, like you were saying before. Like, he'd be in the middle of attacking you and pulling a weapon out from under the couch that the homeowner knows wasn't there this morning.
That's your home. That's your bed. That's your sanctuary. Yeah. And not only is he invading it and you in this way, but he's been there before.
I know.
And he hid something. And you went to bed the night before not knowing that this thing he was going to use against you was under your couch cushion.
I know.
Like, the amount of evil.
I know. And it's why Michelle McNamara is so obsessed with finding him.
Truly.
You can't fucking get away with this. This cannot be a thing that, like, not on her watch, you know?
Exactly. And so she's on her, like, not on my watch brigade. She finds herself on the message board for the A&E show Cold Case Files.
Yeah. And so, like, you guys, message boards are crazy. So, like, all of these cases have communities around them, right? Like, the Maura Murray case, there's a whole online community. Like,
I direct your attention to Don't F with Cats.
Exactly. And so, like, Michelle stumbles upon this message board where there's over 150,000 posts.
And I was just, you know, for someone like me, again, it's like, oh, wow, look at all these. Oh, wow. Like, wait, who would spend, you know, all this time? Well, me, I guess, because it's a week later and I've read 20,000 posts.
She's like, yeah, I looked at it and I thought it was crazy. And cut to me 4 days later, I've read every single one of those posts.
Right. And Patton Oswalt's like, hi, so do you want like a date night? And she's like, no, I'm going to get him.
And so Michelle is telling us, like, you know, there's a lot of different factions on these message boards, but there were people that were starting to stand out right away as like people who were like what Body Movin' was saying and Don't Love with Cats. Like, there were certain people that you knew had their shit together that really cared, that knew the facts that were going to do it. And one of the first ones we meet is his name on the message board was The Kid, but we all now know him as Paul Haynes. So she reaches out to him privately and they develop this rapport. And it's like, it's such a weird world, this world, because although everybody wants to solve the case, everyone's super secretive about like what they know and the shit they've been able to get access to.
It's kind of like everyone for themselves, even though it's bigger than all of them.
Right, right.
But they're still kind of like, what do you know? Whose side are you on? I worked really hard for this information. Can I trust you? Can I give this information to you?
And so he says that, like,
you know, we started exchanging notes and developed a rapport pretty quickly. You know, we just built mutual trust until we were just, you know, openly sharing our work with each other. And that's when we discovered that a lot of it had intersected.
So she also reaches out to someone known as the social worker, but her name is Melanie.
Yes.
And Melanie, I am obsessed with you, Melanie. I am obsessed with your friendship with Michelle. Yeah. I need to dive into all of this.
Like, I know. The thing about Melanie, the social worker, is that like she was kind of known on the board, on the message boards, as like somebody who had a good relationship with law enforcement. She was considered to be somebody who had like inside information. So people like liked her time respected her, but they were also sort of jealous and hated her for that, for this, like, all at the same time.
Yeah, they kind of called her the gatekeeper. Like, she could go back and forth between investigators and, like, the rando message board people.
Yeah.
And the rando message board people would be like, well, why aren't you telling us super secret information from this case? And she's like, because you're on a message board. Like, right. I'll do what I can. Like, Melanie was kind of on the up and up. And so, like, Michelle writes this email to her.
Yeah.
Just, like, this really well-written, like, I would trust Michelle in a second.
Hi. My name is Michelle. I'm a longtime lurker on the Eron's board. The case is of interest to me, and you seem really measured and thoughtful in your responses. I wanted to know if you have any thoughts on something. I spent an afternoon doing some research, and I feel like I've stumbled upon a compelling suspect.
Good thing Michelle has good intentions, because I would be duped by her in a heartbeat. I would say to Mike, I was like, this woman is so open and honest, and like, she gets me, and she's here for the right reasons. Like, it's so well written that the cynical part of me is like, what's her game here? And I'm like, oh no, she's just trying to get justice.
Yeah.
Like, she's just trying to do the right thing, but she's so good at it. So she goes to meet Melanie. She like travels to meet Melanie. They know each other from a message board.
Well, we had been in communication. I knew she was flying into Sacramento, and she was another civilian that was interested in the movement. And we would drive around to the crime scenes. I would take her to the areas. And so we drove around for hours. You know, that was the beginning of a relationship. We'll remain lifelong friends forever.
Like, everyone is saying, like, Michelle is like, I loved her right away. Melanie is like, I love her right away. And Melanie says this. Melanie basically just says, let the women do the work. She's like,
I have that in my notes too. Because we see Melanie today.
Yes.
And she says this quote where it's like, me, some idiot, screams, let the women do the work. But Melanie, when I say that, this is what I mean. Melanie, girl, you have the floor.
There's something about two women getting together that have a common cause and a common goal. And, you know, we're crusaders. We're warriors. We're on the path.
Yeah. Yes, girl. Yes.
And I just felt like, fuck yes. Like, we need more of that.
Yeah. So Melanie takes Michelle and they like drive the crime scene. Remember how Michelle like needed to be in the places to be able to see them, to visualize them. And that helps her in her research and her writing. So we drive to Rancho Cordova, where victims 1 and 3 like live in the same neighborhood.
This is really amazing because Melanie is taking us to the crime scenes and then we get Michelle's footage. So we get this really cool edit of the two of them in the car. Just so thrilled to find like a sister in this.
Yeah,
they're talking a mile a minute and they're talking over each other, but they're not like cutting each other off.
Yep.
They just are finishing each other's sentences and they're so excited and they're like, she finally has like a partner in this and she's so excited. And then we cut to Melanie now and it's like, it looks exactly the same.
Yeah. And I was thinking too, like if I'm watching this documentary and I'm like, I live in Rancho Cordova. That's weird.
Shit.
And then you see them pull up in front of your house and like that's where attack number 1 or 3 happened.
Ugh.
Can you fucking imagine? It's fucking terrifying to be like, that's our neighborhood, babe. Come over here. And they pull up in front of your house. Can you imagine?
And then it's just, you're just, your life turns into slow motion. And it's that shot from Jaws where it's going in but out at the same time. And it's like, we have to move. Great, we're moving now.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, she takes us to house number 1. We hear about, like, I don't want to play a lot of this because it's really triggering and awful. And
it's really hard, guys.
So she takes us to house number 1 where the crime happened on June 18th, 1976. They then drive to house number 3 where crime number 3 happened on August 29th, 1976. It's these terrible attacks on women in both places.
And Melanie is saying, like, I think he was stalking houses for a while before he attacked. Like, she's talking to Michelle about this. And
the neighbor also said that he was hearing for a couple months prior people jumping over his fence. It's my guess that he was actually looking at these houses long before he attacked.
It's one of those things where, I hope I describe this accurately, you can kind of get from one house to the other through the backyard, if that makes sense.
So this becomes important later because we learn that like this is how he would move around. It seems to me like in California, they have a lot of these where like a bunch of houses in a subdivision will have their backyard and a fence, and right behind the fence is like a little like concrete canal almost, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to learn later that that's kind of how he would navigate these neighborhoods. And Melanie is saying, saying, like, if you look down this fence line, all of these houses, like, on all of their backyards, all sort of abut this, like, this one fence line that you could walk up and down and be able to see into everybody's yard with no obstruction. And we learned, too, that the person who lived at the first house where the fence would be to, like, jump over and be able to walk down the backyards, he said that in the months leading up to the attacks on these women in that summer, he heard somebody jumping over that fence all the time. So we learned that he was stalking these houses, trying to figure out people's patterns. It's fucking terrifying.
And then we hear, like, witnesses said, yeah, I did, I did see a masked man naked from the waist down. Do you think that's important? And I'm like, yeah.
That's a real thing, you guys. That actually happened.
A neighbor had seen Ear walking away with no pants on, but could not describe his face.
Like, in one of these attacks, he showed up just naked from the waist down and then fled naked from the waist down, and somebody saw him.
I mean, it's... Again, to quote Leslie Knope, it's all bad. It's all bad.
Right.
But you know what's not bad? We get Patton talking about their lovey relationship. And it starts by saying, like, you know, Michelle was super confident after she got back from this visit with Melanie to Sacramento. Like, because again, she was there. She wasn't just clicking away, as he said. He says this thing where I'm like, oh.
As Michelle was going up doing drive arounds of Sacramento, I saw her confidence growing. It was really exciting to have someone who was, you're in love with someone and they're doing something and you can see how excited and energized they are about it. And that makes you excited and energized.
Well, shit, Patton. That's awesome. More of that, please.
Yeah, and so we get the sort of backstory on how they met. And, you know, he was an actor on a TV show, but he was also doing stand-up
with
gigs.
Leah Remini. He was on King of Queens with Leah Remini.
Did you watch that show?
No, because it's one of those shows where some schlubby guy has the super hot wife.
Totally,
for no reason.
Totally.
For no reason. Yeah. Like, you think Leah Remini is what is with Kevin or whatever his name is? Right. Whatever. Please. But anyway, Patton Oswalt was on that, and it was one of those big, like, popular shows, and yeah.
Yeah. And so he's, like, doing a stand-up gig at this, like, famous place called Largo. She didn't know who he was. And, you know, he has this whole joke about Irish women are his kryptonite.
And then I was just sitting at the bar afterwards, and she was leaving, and she literally tapped me and just went, Irish women, nice. And she was so fucking, like, steamroller gorgeous that I was just stunned. And I literally ran down the street. Hey! And then, like, the first word I ever said to her was, hey! She turned around and went, I'm not going to play any fucking games. I want your name and number so I can take you on a date this weekend. Are you free?
Yeah.
And she went, yeah. I went, good. Give me a number.
On this date, they go see this, like, Italian sci-fi movie, and he thought she was so cool and smart, and he's so intimidated by her. This story is, like, so kind of dated because they were, like, on the phone, like, in bed,
yeah,
and they're, like,
yeah,
flipping around on TV, or he calls her. It's very When Harry Met Sally, when, like, he calls her, and he's like, hey, our favorite movie, Creature of the Black Lagoon, is on, and she's like, girl, I'm already watching it. Let's watch it together. Like,
yeah.
This very, like, cute thing. And the Creature of the Black Lagoon, we'll get back to it. It's the only reason why I'm mentioning it.
And it's terrifying. But this bit ends with Patton trying to explain how he finally, like, won her over. He says he refers to it as his Edward G. Robinson impression. I did not know what that was. Did you?
Oh my God. Okay. Edward G. Robinson. So this is where my, like...
You are a 90-year-old man. Like, sometimes I think you're, like, a 20-year-old gay guy, but then there are other times that you're definitely, like, a 90-year-old man.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I minored in film in college, and this is where that comes out. So, like, Edward G. Robinson is... And Patton does the voice, where it's like, hey, see? Yeah, that kid's got moxie. It's all that.
Yeah, see? Look at the getaway sticks on that tomato. Ooh, look at the keister on that hot number.
Wait, it's what? What's her name does in Parks and Rec? Andy's wife. What's her name? I can't think of her name. Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, yeah, it's
her,
like,
character.
Oh, she's Janet Snakehole. Hey, how about this? Yeah. This one, this sack of potatoes right here. That's it. But Edward G. Robinson was in Double Indemnity, which is one of the best film noirs, like, ever. He was in Key Largo with Bogey. Like, he's just like...
None of these words make any sense.
You don't know
to me.
Who Humphrey Bogart is, girl.
Oh, okay. I know. God, the look on your face, daggers coming out of those Italian eye holes.
Are you a gay man or not? I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. Steve knows who Humphrey is. Steve is more the classic noir films. You.
That's very, very
you
true.
You are Every Night's a Riot. They're very, that's why you balance each other. You are Mai Tais at 11 o'clock. Steve is in bed with Turner Classic Movies at 7:30.
You are every night's a riot. This is why I love you. Oh my God.
But I am both of you. Yes. I'm like, I will watch Turner Classic Movies, but I will also, yes, but after a full day of Mai Tais starting at 11:30 in the morning. It's a very, it's interesting.
Well, I love this because it ends with Patton Oswalt trying to explain why his impression is adorable. And he's like,
you know, couples have in jokes with each other and that became one of my, you know, it was just all that 30s gangster slang. I, you know, however you want to say it, I can't, oh God.
No, but it's like, no, I'm not explaining this right. It's like, and then he finally just puts his head in his hands and he's like, I'm such a dork.
But the thing about that that I loved is like every couple has their own language. You and Steve totally have words that I don't know. Me and Mike, we call each other nicknames. We have little bits. We have a language that nobody knows. And he's talking about this very pivotal, lovey moment in their relationship. And she's not here now. And he's talking about it. And so that part of like his, like when he rubs his face and he's like, oh God, I think it's like every feeling he possibly had in one, yeah, like very raw, sweet kind of like, well, now I got to go watch Double Indemnity, Patton. Thanks.
So then we meet Richard Shelby. He's a detective in Sacramento. He was another one who was on the case from the very beginning.
Yeah, he responded to the call of Survivor number 5, Jane Carson.
Yeah.
But we also meet Carol Daly, and she's a retired detective. Like, Carol says some things here.
When we realized that we first had a series going, the sheriff did not want the media to be aware of it because of what was happening within the rapes. He didn't want the word to get out to make fear in the community.
He had a pattern and they didn't want the media to know. So this is like the cops and the media kind of wrestling here.
And I had a real issue with this because, you know, we're told by the cops now, the sheriff was like, we can't tell anybody that this is happening because we don't know who it is and we have no information to give them. It's going to create mass panic. And I was like, didn't you just say that this was a town where nobody locked the doors?
Right.
Like, if you just told the town, maybe they'd lock the doors and windows and be like, I say empower the people. I say give them the fucking information.
Right.
Like, so women can stop being raped for no reason.
That would be wonderful. That would be really great.
Yeah.
But so the cop.
Should I run for sheriff, girl?
Yeah, my platform would be stop raping people. Stop raping. Right. Stop raping, period. I would run on that platform.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'd probably lose because that's welcome to 2020. I would lose. No, I would be like the third party candidate. No one would give a shit. They'd be like, there's that hysterical woman talking about her feelings again. What an idiot. She has the smallest brain out of anyone here. She can go. Welcome to 2020.
She has even a small brain for a woman.
Even for a woman. It's like, it's really, we don't most study her, but we don't care enough about what she thinks. Is there a ditch we could just throw her in? Can we just shut her up real quick? Great.
We would almost study her, but we can't be wasting valuable time and resources on that.
So stupid. Who cares? I don't even want to know. I don't know. Look at her arms, by the way. Look how puny. What an idiot. What a weak arm, small brained idiot. She can't even lift, probably. Does she even lift? Probably not.
Oh my God.
So the cops say to the press, hey girl, please don't print anything. We're totally going to catch them. Please don't say anything. Please don't say anything.
The media became aware of it. The sheriff said, please don't print anything. We're going to catch this guy. And then as time went on and we didn't catch the guy, the media said, okay, we're going to start printing. That was when the whole community was brought in.
And they have a community meeting about the Golden State Killer. And this is when some cop is telling...
This is unbelievable. You guys, I made a joke in a Simply Safe ad about this, that like, this cop is up there being like, you guys, look, we didn't want to tell you about this. The media forced our hands. Right. There is a rapist. There's a serial rapist in our midst. Mm-hmm. And here's how you protect yourself. It's a simple security system, you guys. It's so fucking easy, you idiots.
It's a 32-step plan. It's very simple.
You can use a simple alarm system. Mount a bell device on the outside of your home. String some wires to a power source and then string the other set of wires right to a nightstand and have a toggle switch there. And if you ever hear the glass breaking, reach over on your nightstand and flip the switch. The bell goes off on the outside.
He literally is like, so you take the cord and you connect it to the other cord. You get a light bulb, you screw it into the ceiling, and then you get a noisemaker. There's twine involved.
It's basically the commercial for Mousetrap where it's like, ring the bell and do the thing. And it's a mousetrap, but at the end you catch the Golden State Killer. And And you have to remember, like, it's the 70s. There's no, is there like a piece of paper that I can take home? Is there a graph or a diagram? Right. Or am I just supposed to be terrified that there is a serial rapist on the loose who eludes you, police officer? And also just remember the 38-point plan of how to protect my home with a bell and a piece of tape.
So we're back to Larry Crompton. Remember, he's the original detective that wrote the book that Michelle was like obsessed with.
Yeah.
He tells us this horrible thing, you guys.
A lot of people don't realize this, but 6 rapes in Sacramento out of the first 10, 6 of them were teenagers, and 2 of them were 15 years old.
People don't realize that 6 out of the first 10 rapes were teenagers. 2 of them were 15 years old.
Yeah, and survivor number 10 is Chris Pedretti. And you guys, we're going to go through this real quick because this...
Yeah, we're not going to play any of this. She was a young kid. She was 15. There was a school dance on December 18th, and she stayed home because she wasn't feeling well. Her parents went to a party. Her sister was at work, and, like, she describes playing the piano. This is, like, this kills me.
She's, like, such a good kid where she's, like, home, and she, like, gets all cozy for the night, and, like, she has her slippers on. She eats her pizza, and she's going to play piano, and as she's playing piano, she thinks she hears a noise, and she's like, well, of course I heard a noise, right? I'm home alone. I'm 15. Like, you're always thinking that someone's right behind you. And the thing that rips your heart out is that somebody was behind her.
Yeah. And, like, the long and the short of it is, like, I mean, he brutally rapes her over and over again for hours. Yep. And she's just, like, sitting here telling us the story. And she's, like, you know, she's obviously, she's okay. She's a survivor. I love that this film refers to them all as survivors. And, you know, she says that, like, the thing that was just, like, so telling, it was such a metaphor for this, was that after that, she could never play the piano again because she always felt like there was somebody standing right behind her.
Yeah, that's that was the thing that made me really stand up and have to take like a 10-minute break. Like, she loved this thing so much, and it gutted me.
It's terrible. So we're getting to the end of the episode, and remember how Michelle was pitching this article to Los Angeles Magazine, and the editor and the whatever her name, what was
the
her
reporter
name?
Nancy. Yeah, Nancy.
Yeah, and Nancy really like liked the story, but was like, girl, we gotta find a way to tie it to now, right?
Because she keeps saying, she makes her editor sound like a piece of shit, because she's like, this is really important, but my editor's not gonna like it. We gotta make it a little juicy. And I'm like, Nancy, like, somewhere that editor is like, that's not exactly what I said. I just said, because Nancy says 15 times,
I have to pitch this to my editor-in-chief. Everyone loves a story about a killer. But in order to get her interested, I had to convince her that this story was relevant now, and that it was like a Los Angeles and a California story.
I know this is really important, but like, what have you done for me lately? And somewhere I feel, unless that editor's total garbage, then fine. But the way I'm like, wow, this woman must be a piece of shit, because she's just like, you got anything else? What, 50 rapes and 10 deaths? That's nothing. And I'm like, oh my God, Nancy.
I know. But Michelle's got an ace in the hole, because remember, her best friend is Melanie, and Melanie has access to all these police files. And so we hear a tape. Michelle recorded everything. She goes to Melanie's house and she's like,
I pitched LA Magazine your story, and they're interested in doing it, possibly, which would be amazing. I mean, that would be like the kind of publicity that just you can't buy, you know? If there's any way I could look at whatever you have, and I won't copy anything, I just look at it and take notes and then give it back to you tomorrow, at least then I can say, I saw case files.
Girl, I pitched this story to Los Angeles Magazine. That's good for us, for them to run this story, because we think this guy is still alive. We think he's still out there. We think that he is catchable. And this kind of a major article would be like what we need. But girl, what I need from you is I need those files, girl. I've got to be able to go to this editor and say, I've seen something that nobody else has seen. So can I have access to your files?
And Melanie's like, usually I'd say no, but we're best friends now. Right. And Melanie's like, look, if the message board only knew, like, I swore my life that I wouldn't let anyone see these. So how about this? You look at them now, here in front of me.
Yeah.
I cannot let these files leave my house. I can't break confidence, because technically they just said they couldn't leave my home. They're not leaving my home if you're looking at it on my living room couch, girl. So go through all those files and, you know, let's see. And Michelle goes, well, how many pages are there? And she goes, I'm like 4,000 or 5,000.
Right. But then Melanie has a change of heart, because she's like, wait,
I should make a trade with you today. You let me take this today, and I'll let you take the cases today.
Wow.
And then we give them back.
And then we give them back. I would do that. I would do that, but we have to give them back.
I can't believe I'm doing this, but...
I want to see your information. So how about this? You give me your information. I'll give you this flash drive with all 5,000 like files on it right now. You've got 24 hours. Go to your hotel. Do your thing. I'll do my thing. In the morning, we'll reconnect. We'll give each other our shit back.
You hear Melanie go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. She's like, she's like, the kid is going to kill me. Or like, we're going to get him. Golden Eron. We're going to get Eron's. It's going to totally get me. Good thing Body Movin' wasn't on that board because she would have really. You got to follow the rules.
And I remember this so vividly from the book because anybody who's obsessed with any particular case, if you get like a windfall of information on this thing, like Michelle cannot get back to her hotel fast enough. She's running red lights. She's going a million miles an hour. She's like going on and on about how like...
Ahead of me was a rare 24-hour stretch without interference or distraction. No tiny hands slicked with paint asking to be washed. No preoccupied, hungry husband to inquire about dinner.
No fucking kid to bother me. No hungry husband to bother me.
No hungry husband, Michelle.
I know. And she does. She gets back to the hotel and she just like puts in that flash drive and goes through every single thing she ever wanted to know about the Golden State Killer.
And now, like, this is why I love these HBO docs. When they're done right, they are just like chef's kiss. They are just so good.
Yeah, totally.
Because part of the thing that Michelle and Patton bonded over was their love of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. And so Michelle is learning, oh my God, these canals that you were describing earlier that were in these neighborhoods, he would like travel through these canals. And as we get the Amy Ryan voiceover of Michelle discovering this, we get footage of the Creature from the Black Lagoon, like as this, like, you know, like,
it's terrifying. I've never seen this before. I'm watching it. There's like this beautiful woman swimming in a lake, and you see this like sea creature from the bottom of the lake,
Black Lagoon,
like swimming, swimming up towards her. And it's like, I have an underwater fear thing anyway that BuzzFeed tells me is real, so I stand by it.
You don't need BuzzFeed. I'll tell you that it's real, girl.
I have like, there's something about looking at images of deep water, like
you and Natalie Wood, it's terrifying.
Yes. But I like the water. I like swimming. I know how to swim. But like, anyway, I'm watching this creature like emerge, like about to attack this woman. Oh, I'm getting like the chills just thinking about it. It's so terrifying.
It's so funny because if you watched it not in this context, if you and Steve just like rented it or watched it, you'd be like, look at that. You could totally see the gloves and the mask. Like, it's so old that you would be like, this is, I can't believe they fell for it. But because the music and like we're an hour into this thing and we're like, oh my God, he's actually the creature. And then it comes back to their love story and we're obsessed. But so she says this thing. She's like,
he was doing reconnaissance. He was studying people, learning when they were home. That means that women exist who, because of change of schedule or luck, were never victims. But they felt something terrifying brush against them.
Women exist who, because of change of schedule or luck, were never victims. But like you, girl, she's talking to you. They felt something terrifying brush up against them. And it ends with this email of Nancy being like, girl, we got it. The story's a go. You finally told me something interesting enough. Let's do this. Episode over. Chills everywhere. I'm so in. Oh, I'm so in.
Thank you for listening to episode one of All Begone in the Dark. You can get the rest of the series right now on Patreon, which is where you can also find over 150 full bonus episodes to download and binge immediately.
Yeah, and also ad-free versions of what's on this feed.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's not forget that.
I just want to say one more time, it's one of my most favorite documentaries series we've ever covered. I think it's some of our best work. I hope you guys will check it out.
Yeah, it's just, we loved the series and there's just so much waiting for you on the Patreon. If you're into it, great. If you're not, that's totally cool. Thanks for hanging for this hour and we'll see you at your leisure and convenience. There's no pressure.
If you want to find it, it's patreon.com/truecrimeobsessed, or you can go to our website, click on the Patreon link, and we love you guys.
We love you.
Thanks for letting this be our job, you guys.
Thanks. Seriously, thank you. Seriously. All right. Thank you.
Seriously, thank you. All right, bye.
Bye.